study. Welcome to Policy Talk. My name is Yatish Rajawat, and today we have a interesting or a distracted view of the world that we are going to talk about. Distraction is all around us. It is in our devices, including our smartphones and these laptops or computers that you are seeing. And we have two people with us to talk to us about that. Nandan Nelekani, founder and chairman of Infosys Technologies. Tanuj Bhojwani, senior fellow and a frequent writer on technology subjects at iSpirit. They've written a wonderful book, actually, on the art of fitfulness, which basically talks about how to manage our life, how to manage our productivity, where to devote our time, and how to get out of this distraction that basically now runs our life. So welcome, Nandan. Welcome, Tanuj.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I wanted to first of all ask both of you that what is the primary message that you want to give to this book that you've written?
Well, I think let me start by saying that we believe that technology is enormously empowering, enormously useful to society, and both of us in different ways have been technology evangelists for a long time. However, I think the way we use technology, especially consumer technology, has to be done in a way that we get the benefit out of that, rather than being, you know, doing things that other people would like us to do. And therefore, being on top of your technology and getting the best value for it is what this book is all about. And of course, the larger issue of how do we build ecosystems of the same type. Tanuj?
That's it. I think the subtitle captures it, keeping calm in the digital world. If you keep calm, I think you'll be able to, like Nandan is saying, get on top of your life, live your best life, as well as build a society that we all would like to live in.
So, I mean, keeping calm in a information soaked world, and you quote Herbert Simon quite actively in your book, what we are losing is our attention. And we all the time seem to be distracted with the information or messages. And what you suggest is that not to spend less time, but to spend it better. Do you think that, most behavioral or habit gurus, have this formula that if you want to change behavior, or if you want to change the way you do things, you need to stop the bad or the toxic part of your behavior, like smoking, You can't half smoke, or you can't smoke less. You have to give up smoking. So how does this work in the digital world? Can we actually create, do partial detoxification and then pretend that we are now calm?
Excellent question. Can I take this one? You put your finger on the message. Simple rules are more effective. I will not smoke is more effective than, at sometimes 98% of the times I'll smoke. I will not eat sugar is more effective than, I will try to restrict calories to less than this much and do complicated maths. Similarly, when it comes to digital, I don't think we're saying, because it's impossible, think about it. It's impossible for us to even have this podcast right now without digital. So for us to have a blanket search ban is simple, but ineffective. We're going to falter. So what is a simple set of rules that you can follow that lets you keep your sanity, keep your peace? And that's what we talk about in the book. We talk about how you can create simple boundaries. And through those simple boundaries, you have a choice at every moment. Am I doing deep work? Am I writing? Am I doing it right now? And therefore, how do I be in the right zone for that work? Nandan?
Yeah, no, absolutely. See, unlike cigarettes where, you not smoking is good for your health, I don't think it's practical or feasible or even right to give up on your digital devices, because they are a source of enormous value, productivity, entertainment, information, communication. So they have massive value of that. So it's not about giving it up or leading some kind of a monastic existence. It's about using it in a more effective way to get the full value and remain calm in a chaotic world.
You say another thing very interesting in the book. You said that, and it sounds like a guru statement, we know what we should do, but we don't do that. And because if we find it difficult or, we procrastinate on it, I think the exact statement is doing what we know we should do feels hard and is known to be phenomenologically aversive, So I had a question on this. Does this aversiveness only apply to individuals, or is it applicable to institutions too?
Anil, you want to start?
Oh, it definitely applies to individuals, right? In the sense that if you ask somebody like, you know, I lost weight in 2021, about 30 kilos, and it's not, I'm 31 then. It's not that for the previous 30 years, I did not know what to do to lose weight. Right? I just had to do it. Yeah. And, you know, your questions on institutions, whether institutions find it hard to do what they should do, I think Nandan is better suited to answer. But institutions are made of individuals, right? So I know, I'm guessing we have a hint to the answer. But Nandan.
No, institutions face the same challenges because often, you know, also because people have finite roles in institutions, their tenure is fixed and the institution is much longer, they rather, you know, push the football to the next guy, partly because they don't want to take the pain of the change, and partly because the benefit of the change will not accrue to them because they'll have retired by then. So institutions have some peculiar additional things that often prevent change from happening.
Another thing, I don't know whether you have noticed, you know, you walk into any CXO's office or, you know, any minister or a senior bureaucrat's office, and you have a laptop, you have a computer, you have his mobile phone on the TV, and there is a TV forever on in his office. And then he's having a conversation with you and maybe with 8 or 10 people. So at the highest level, at the topmost level, we see the highest level of distraction. How is that affecting decisions, and how is that affecting policy making per se, in your opinion?
No, I think that's extremely distracting. And, you know, you end up with so many demands and pulls on your time. There's a cricket match going on the TV. Somebody coming in saying, I want a transfer. Somebody else is saying, budget approval chahiye. Somebody else, you know, it's. I've seen this personally, by the way. I've been in meetings where I've got 5 other people along with me all making different, and it's impossible to have a communication. But let me also tell you that I've worked with some of the top leaders in the country, and they are not like that. When I've gone to meet Mr. Modi, he gives you his undivided attention for that whatever time he has allotted. He does not have a single device there. There's not a piece of paper there, and he gives you a complete complete attention. And listens to you or talks to you. And many others do that. I mean, I've seen that with Mr. Manmohan Singh, Dr. Manmohan Singh. I've seen that across the board, but the top leaders are extremely focused. So while there are some people who are distracted all the time, and in some sense, that's what we talk about. You know, I mean, we are saying that you need to sometimes shut out all these random notifications, communications, and focus, whether it's in a meeting. In fact, it's a good idea not to take your devices into a meeting, because then, you know, you get distracted.
Tanit, you have a say on this?
I mean, you're right. I want to talk more about why they feel that way. I think a lot of us feel this, that we need to be on top of information all the time. But I want to echo what Nandan is saying, that great leaders are on top of the moment, not on top of everything in the world, right? And if you are present in that moment and giving it your best, you are more productive and effective than anybody can be. So I think it's a very counterintuitive to the natural tendency and feeling that you think you want all these information sources and you want to be reactive. But the best leaders, like Nandan are saying, are focused and proactive.
So what would you say about people who keep switching context, and you say in your book that it has enormous cognitive cost and also affect the quality of decision. What would you say to them about meetings or about discussion per se, in which they're carrying their laptops, mobile phones, and television sets?
No, I think, you know, there's no question. I mean, I won't do a meeting with a television blaring in the background. It's out of the question. And during the meeting, you know, I would not keep my devices close by, because I do believe that, you know, when you meet somebody, you have to give them the complete undivided attention, that you need to converse with them, you need to listen to them. Otherwise, what's the point of the meeting? And so I'm maybe old school in that way, but I do believe that you should give your meeting undivided attention.
I want to compliment Nandan's point here by telling him that this is genuinely how he treats it. If he thinks it's not worth a meeting, he will call you and settle it on the phone. If it's a text, he'll do that. So I think there is something to be said about being sort of ferociously protective of both your time and attention, others' time and attention, which I see Nandan put into practice, you know, on a day-to-day basis.
I have this theory, Atish, that I'm generous with my money and stingy with my time. Because for me, time is the only resource which is finite. And the older I get, the less time I have. And therefore, I am very, very conscientious about how I spend my time. And I turn down so many things. Or as Tanuj said, I convert them into phone calls or messages or emails. And therefore, I'm very, very particular. But once I give that time for the meeting, then I give it my undivided attention.
Yeah, I know that too. Seen that in action. I wanted now, you know, discuss a couple of important issues that you've raised in the book, which are not individual related. They're more internet related. And Nandan, you've spoken about these issues in the past. And, you know, they've not caught on in the larger narrative, but you talk about the fact that basically, the way that we are building the internet, you know, we face an existential crisis here. And this model of attention-sucking internet based on advertising revenue, it's been criticized by other people also. But I remember you also mentioned sometime back, and in your book also, you said, talk about the micropayment-based internet, you know, that is a possibility. So how can that become possible? Is there a role for policy here? Is there a role for maybe government here? Where does the trigger happen?
No, I think India actually has come a long way in building a transactional internet. As we said in the book, when the original internet was designed, it sort of prematurely became a commercial offering. After 95, you had Netscape, and then you had all the internet giants coming along. And there was no business model designed in that internet, which led to advertising, attention seeking, and so on. So what we have today in India, for example, because of UPI, is a very high volume, very low, zero cost micropayment infrastructure where you can make a 5 rupee or 10 rupee payment, you know, very efficiently from a phone to another phone, a phone to a desktop, whatever. And that is led to, in fact, I believe India's internet economy will be transaction led. It will not be advertising led. India doesn't have, as of now, such a large advertising market like the West has. But that's why you're seeing the rise of e-commerce, vertical e-commerce. Everything is transactional. And unlike the old payment systems, which went from the physical world to the digital world, in this era, digital-first payment systems, the UPI, will start in the digital world and move into the physical world where you buy your stuff from a physical store. So I believe that we actually have the infrastructure for a micropayment-based internet, and I think it's happening already. Last month, UPI did 4.5 billion transactions worth over 100 billion. So it's a real system that's creating real opportunity for consumers, sellers, and for the ecosystem.
I agree that it's revolutionized the payment system per se. But how has it created anything in terms of the content consumption? For instance, there is no social media entity which is based on micropayment, like a counterpart of Facebook. There is no information search engine which is currently based on the micropayment system. These are the two or three crucial, or there's no OTT platform. Even if it is micropayment, it will still consume our attention more than it needs to. I mean, so, but the other two infrastructure are still not still advertising there.
No, true. That is because of the, you know, the advertising and the search and social media are dominated by global players. So, and it'll be difficult for an Indian company. But for example, subscriptions today, you know, you can do a Netflix subscription or a Disney Hotstar subscription using UPI, and you can use the auto pay so that every month you can debit your account with 5 rupees or 10 rupees or whatever it is that they're charging for the subscription. And you're also seeing a lot of
enabling that to happen, Nandan, instead of We are enabling an attention-sucking app to take over the attention of more and more people by facilitating the payment system.
Look, if the existing apps that are advertising-based and they are very dominant, you can't do much about that. But what you can do is make sure that new things that emerge are all transaction-based, which is what is happening in India, by the way. All the companies are now transaction-based. And even, for example, you know, as you go towards the so-called creator economy, you will end up with creators selling on YouTube or Reels or TikTok, and they'll all be transaction-based.
A nuanced view of this that I was just at the Lit Fest having this conversation also, where the social media platforms, what they don't realize is that through their own business model, they're writing themselves into obliquity, basically like getting themselves, making it their own worst enemies. Because there was a time when Facebook and Instagram were had a lot of content that we shared, our photos, our posts, our thoughts. And in that, they inserted advertisements. With this creator influencer economy, all these free platforms, all these ad revenue platforms will basically be either advertising as put in there by Facebook or advertising as put in by influencers for their own whatever they're shilling, to the point where these just become the billboards, right? This becomes the bad channels, but you still have your HBOs in that sense. If you go back to the cable TV eras, right, you have these premier places of content, and those could not have existed without a transaction economy. Right. So eventually, like Nandan is saying, instead of these large, very broad platforms, you will have small niches, each of them that you can selectively pay for, channels which are curated. And these large platforms are becoming billboards. They're becoming noise more than, you know,
in fact, Yadesh, just take your own sector of media. One of the biggest trends in media is subscription, publications. And today, publications both in India and abroad are increasingly going to subscription models or pay-per-view models. A lot of people are going to them because they are willing to pay with the subscription as long as they get curated high-value content. So you're seeing that happening in media, both in the West and in India. And you're seeing the rise of many subscription-based media, in your own group, the Money Control has a subscription-based, ET Prime has, Information has, Ken has. So we're seeing a lot more of this subscription-based because people also want real curated news from quality journalists.
Yeah, but they're very small. I mean, their news-gathering teams are very small. You know, Money Control is largely data. Nobody subscribes to... So people are still dependent on free content and free... So it's like...
Yeah, but that is
99% of it is still...
I agree, but I mean, like, Bloomberg has become so successful globally. Bloomberg Media began as a sort of an adjunct to Bloomberg terminals, but today Bloomberg Media has become a huge subscription business by itself. People who have nothing to do with the financial markets are subscribing to Bloomberg Media because they have excellent curated articles and opinions.
Yeah. I want to take you to another part of this internet infrastructure model that you talks about, especially the winner takes all model of the internet. And this is affecting not just attention or people distracting people. This is affecting a large segment of the several industries. You know, like the OTT has affected both the movie entertainment and print industry or media industry in a negative manner. Now, is there a way to intervene or prevent these winner-take-all model from establishing itself? Like it has done in the West, is there a way that these companies can be prevented from becoming all-powerful and all-controlling? Is there a place for a regulatory control here?
Well, a lot of the activity in the West is regulation and monopoly laws and so on to do this. But our view is that you also need to do it through technology. And our view is that you should not allow the creation of a walled garden, which means that you need to have interoperability and portability across platforms. So I should be able to, if I'm on one social media platform and I have a bunch of followers, I should be able to go to another social media platform and take my followers with me or take my user group with me, my contact list. If a new product comes, then we can move quickly. While you can do some of it through regulation and so on, It also has to be done by email. Email is something where I may be on Gmail, you may be on Yahoo, he may be on Hotmail or Outlook. And we don't care because the email formats are interoperable. Same with UPI. I can be doing UPI on PhonePe. You may be doing UPI on Paytm. Tanuj may be doing UPI on Google Pay. It doesn't matter to us. So I think building interoperable systems and where government or government-enabled organizations create these rails is a very important thing, which is what we talk about in the third part of the book.
So you're talking about data portability and identity portability across platform for individuals.
And interoperability, in the sense, suppose so the new, very, suppose,
Who builds the interoperability? Does it come
to regulation? That is part of the legal and technical, it's a techno-legal thing. You create a legal infrastructure that demands portability, and then you create interoperable protocols that you mandate, which everyone has to use. I mean, email is a good example. Everybody uses SMTP protocol. So once you use that, you can get connected to everyone. I mean, if you look at Gmail came much after Hotmail and Yahoo, but they gave a superior product with unlimited storage and all that, and they got a lot of clients. So,
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we lost the last part. But you want to add to this, Tanuj, in terms of...
Yeah, no, look, what Nandan is saying is that, technology, unlike, say, climate change or a pandemic, we have to actually build hospital primary care centers, build a vaccine, distribute the vaccine. Technology is all code. It's sort of Lego bricked up, like this. Then on top of that, you add layers. The fundamental layer is usually what these companies try to own. So Uber tries to own the network of riders and drivers. But that fundamental network, all you need to make it public or a public good is that the protocol itself is open. It is for anybody can sort of, latch onto it, just like with email. And that protocol needs to be...
That is where the proprietariness of the protocol or the platform comes in. I mean, do you think Amazon or Uber will ever allow anybody to port over both their customer base and their seller base,
So this is where
maximum conflict is there. This is they will go back and say that we built it, we invested thousands, hundreds of millions of dollars in this over the last so many years. Why should we open it up?
No, I mean, the question is, why should they not, right? I mean, I'm sorry, but this is also our world and our society that we live in, right? The idea is that...
Is the argument there from a larger social point of view?
Look, there is tremendous power. So first of all, these networks are built not necessarily. So they've invested a lot in changing behavior and changing habits. And if they have a successful brand for the consumers, I don't think people will switch out, just because. They can still continue to offer better service, innovation, more features, and consumers will stick to them. Nobody's taking away that right. The idea is that today it's a virtuous cycle. If you already have a network, you tend to be getting more of the network because of what is called network effects, right? If I have to new buyer or a new seller, I will go to the platform where there are most buyers. So, right, it's always like it is that virtuous thing. Now, to give a fair chance at competition, that is the number one argument for markets.
We need to rewrite the competition law one, and then we need to write maybe a data and an identity law second, and third, then we need to create a protocol, as Nandan is saying, that there needs to be a protocol that will talk to all these platforms and allow a third platform to emerge if needed, or if a third platform want to emerge.
To make it faster, I would reverse the steps. The steps are correct, but what I would do is that first we would make the protocol, right? And let markets come in and create new competing products on top of that, because something new like this creates opportunity. Other VCs will put in money. Users will see the benefit of having their data portable and being on an interoperable network. And you might start seeing the shift without the need for state intervention. But then if it's not happening, then state intervention accordingly in proportional quantities and in proportional measures can then, help this change, right? That's what I think Nandan and I are both saying, that let private innovation also do its job. It's not just a state problem.
So the account aggregator falls into this perfectly.
Totally. It is an ecosystem of multiple players, and people are empowered with their own data. So a small business can get its bank statement or its tax details and give it to a lender, and a lender can decide to give you a loan. But you control the data and you use a third-party impartial consent manager to navigate all this.
And of course, the non-personal data draft had this provision that there would be trustees who could aggregate data and, you know, build it for all other industries too.
Yeah, that is for non-personal data. A is more for personal data of individuals and businesses.
So how will it happen in the e-commerce space? I'm very keen to know.
Well, there is this whole initiative called ONDC, Open Network for Commerce. And ONDC has been set up. There's tremendous interest. Many people want to be shareholders. They've appointed a management team. And that will essentially disaggregate the pieces of commerce, which is suppliers, delivery, the technology in between, consumers, and allow more and more people to plug into an interoperable network using the ONDC protocol. So the ONDC protocol is a good example of an open protocol for e-commerce.
Who does the logistics in the ONDC and who owns the platform?
So there can be multiple, you know, today we are seeing great companies coming which are dedicated to delivery alone, like Delivery or Shadowfax or Dunzo or, you know, so many of them out there, Elastic Run, and the many of them, all of whom do only delivery and logistics for a living. They will act as a third-party arm for this, can act as a third-party. Or somebody may offer their own. I mean, you could have a company that has a delivery capability, but also out you'll bundle it out. I mean, unbundle it. For example, Amazon does that. You know, Amazon offers fulfillment and all that, where they use their own fulfillment network for other merchants. So once you unbundle this, then how the market will organize this will depend on situation to situation.
And how would the customer, who would be the customers? Who will onboard the customers on this platform?
That could be multiple platforms. I mean, I may be a Paytm customer buying a brand from Mensa brand, get it delivered by delivery. So, or I could be a PhonePe customer, you know, buying from, you know, some direct to consumer, you know, Nykaa or something, and having it delivered with Shadowfax. So there are many ways to do this.
So you're saying that all payment systems which are looking at entry into e-commerce could use the ONDC network, and they don't need to build their own platform. They can just plug in and play. And
So they don't have to build an end-to-end e-commerce platform. They can connect to a large number of suppliers, and they can connect to multiple delivery platforms and offer the consumers an e-commerce service.
That's interesting. So, I mean, who will own ONDC then at the end of the day?
ONDC is a non-profit company being set up with multiple shareholders, but run as a non-profit, and government also has a, it's like NPCI for commerce.
Oh, okay. Okay. Same structure, but the objective is to decentralize the e-commerce.
Yes.
And we'll,
to create a public commons of e-commerce on which is interoperable, right? That's the more, it's not decentralized, but then this entity will also have some say. But the idea is that the core infrastructure becomes fair in a market competition wise.
Fair to the buyer and the seller.
Yeah, and also another small guy. I mean, small retailer can be on this platform, and he can offer because the discovery is commons. If I want to buy something, a retailer close to my house can say, I'll sell it to you, and my shop is 500 meters from your house, I'll deliver it to you also. So allow the small merchant to participate, retailer as well as SME manufacturers can also offer their products directly onto this platform.
So the matching will happen, you're saying that the algorithm will match the nearest seller to the buyer.
Consumer will be offered certain choices, he will decide whom to buy it from.
So you can imagine, Nitish, that there'll be like today there is, you know, you go to Amazon or whatever, it's the one place, it's the big, large place. And that was probably what was needed in the early internet. Today, when everything is on the internet, the needs of the consumer changes. Say, I want to decide that I want to shop local or I want to shop responsibly. So there might be another provider who only does that, where they do discover and trusting of brands which fulfill those criteria. There might be somebody else who does something else. And so, you know, this is what you hope that many competition consumer choices will emerge when you have this kind of infrastructure, because the market is not one large market in the way that it's been aggregated today.
So I attended a workshop which ONDC had done to educate people about the platform, and the way they explained it is very different from what the way you have explained it. I assumed that was the objective, but now you verbalized that objective much more clearly. So thank you for that.
Thanks.
Nandan, you're saying
no, thank you. Thanks, Sachin.
No, just I want to now ask three questions directly related to individuals, the individual part of your book. which is one issue that you talk about is how journaling reduces stress. And you talk about, you know, the ability to cope with the anxiety, you know, reduces symptoms of depressions, improves personal relationship. And you talk about something called as a working memory. Just tell our viewers about this connection between journaling and working memory and elaborate on working memory a little bit more.
Anuj.
Yeah. So, so first of all, you know, starting caveat, we try to do a lot of research and sort of make sure that what we are saying is not, you know, as you said, guru-like, but more backed in fact and what we can prove. Sometimes you have to admit that we may not understand the mechanisms, but we understand the outcomes, right? We can show the correlation, we may not understand the causation. And journaling is one of those things where you can find numerous studies which with enough power to explain and say that, you know, on overall happiness and well-being, if you just do something as simple as what's called gratitude journaling, which is write down three things every day, what you are, grateful for. It redirects your attention to what is good in your life. Do it for 21 days, your happiness levels increase, right? It's one of the few things we know that make you happy. So first caveat, it works. Why it works, we may not be able to answer. But what we can tell you is experiences, which both of us share, even though despite us, is that number one, when we write down, we both feel that we take it out of our mind and onto paper, which means that we can stop worrying altogether about that idea or that subject because, you know, it's on a piece of paper. Second, if it's a journal or an actual, maybe a digital notes app that you use in one place, then all your thoughts
are fine. Which is the best app that both of you have identified for journaling?
I mean pen and paper.
But then how do you search on pen and paper, Nandan?
No, I have a very, very good notification system where I do it by day, I do it by topic. And I also have a very good system of archiving in my email. So I have a lot of ways where I don't burden my short-term memory with things. I put them in the right place and forget about it.
Similar, but digitally.
For example, you journal for today and you do it on paper. How does the email come into the play there?
No, I'm saying there is a physical world. Some journaling I do in writing. I meant that parallelly when I do digital things on my email, I do that.
So I use something called Roam Research, roamresearch.com. It's called network thinking. Basically, what it does is, I'll just give you the effect, forget the feature list. The effect for me is that I can start writing without worrying about organizing, right? So every time I feel like this thought is related to some idea, I just add a few hashtags. And later when I need to retrieve those ideas and it allows you to write queries, like very simple stuff to retrieve your thoughts on any particular idea, anything. So even if
I use Google Keep for that.
So Google Keep also has hashtags and it's a great way to do this.
See, and then it archives with your email. So it kind of syncs with the email. So when you're searching Keep, you can search the mail also along with it.
So look, ultimately what works for you, right? We've tried not to be prescriptive about this part of the book because we know that...
I think this is where the best thing would have been prescriptive, or at least give us some 5 or 10 examples of apps that you could use.
So, and this is just a shout out. On our social media, we're starting to do this where we are down how...
Taraj will launch you there.
Sorry, so I was saying that for the book, we wanted this stuff to be timeless. These technologies will change and evolve and our book will look like it was written for somebody else. So you wanted to keep the philosophy of why and how these changes and how these systems work. Because, surprisingly, we mentioned this early in the book, Nandan and I, despite our age difference, despite the sort of when we started using technology, etc., our methods are similar. The way we stay on top of information turned out to be surprisingly similar, which is why we decided to write this book in the first place. That, there seems to be some things here which are essential enough to be timeless.
The trigger for both of you to come together to write this book? Was there Nandan?
No, I think what happened was during the past, digital dependence went even more. Obviously, we were using a lot of devices all the time. But when the pandemic, you're cooped up at home, your work is all done over Zoom and email. Your entertainment is watching Netflix or browsing the net. You're ordering food from Swiggy or Zomato, whatever. Everything was on digital. And to break the monotony of this, I started a practice called walk in the park. So every day I would go for a walk in the park. And this was when the pandemic had slightly come down and they allowed us to walk in the park. and wearing masks and all that. So then I used to call my friends for a chat because I thought that was better than doing Zoom calls all the time. And once Tanuj and I went, Tanuj and I did this and we were just thinking about how do we cope with this digital onslaught. And then as we shared notes, we realized that both of us have the same philosophy, but the actual implementation, of course, we have different methods. And then we said, maybe putting all this together will help people as we come out of the pandemic, as they try to bring some kind of normalcy into their life, as they start getting out. Is there a way to make them more effective with the digital technology and, you know, keep peace of mind? That's what led to this book.
So this is unlike any other book that you've written in the past, because it is more a self-help, individual.
I think, Yatish, what we did was we did it self-help because we wanted some value for the reader. But it's also a deep book about policy and how to deal with it. It's also there. But we began with helping individuals and then connecting the dots to the larger issue that society is faced with technology.
So then there is a need for doing a second book, which is primarily focused on that part aspect of it. Because why?
Let's see.
Another thing, there's a whole chapter in the book about, you know, how to think clearly and what to think about, you know. Can you summarize that, and also how can, you know, this aspect be, say, taught in schools or colleges? Because I think thinking itself is one of the most crucial skills or a meta skill that will be needed for future.
So I'll take the summary part and let Nandan answer on, you know, how to get it to schools. But our summary is that thinking is one of those things that, you know, everybody just assumes you know how to do by default, right? Because of course you're thinking. The example we start with is how you look for keys, right? You're basically frantic, you know, and you think that as long as I keep moving and I keep, you know, searching, pillaging, I am searching. But a proper search is calmer. It is systematic. You try to see that your keys will be, right? Like last night's pants, you know, where you usually keep them, etc., wherever you last saw them. Similarly, thinking also, there is a way to do it systematically. There is a way to sort of make sure that instead of just worrying and going in circles over the same thoughts, you can go think, rethinking in the problem and break down your thoughts. And we believe that the best way to do that, the way to focus your attention, is writing. There is, this has been known for thousands of years. There are people who have better quotes than what we've written in the book on why writing is important and how it is important. Now, one is, of course, journaling and sort of self-talk and doing this. And we have a whole section on how to do that. We call it pitfulness meditation. But there are also systems of thinking, by which I mean systems of writing, whereby you can, you know, achieve a certain or specific objective. And in the book, we give an example that has actually gotten wildly popular, you know, it's been tweeted and went viral and etc. was this example we give of how Azim Premji manages his promises to people, because what was most important to him was making sure that he does not renege on any promise he makes, even if it's a fleeting promise made in a hallway. And he did this through writing. So, you know, we give these, you know, how to think and is this part. And what to think about is essentially a chapter on how to manage your time. Because we think that in the digital world, you know, the problem of, you have a problem of plenty. There's a lot to do. There's every time there's an email or a message or a thing, there's something at you. Somebody's tweeted an interesting article, you want to read it. So the real skill here is what to think about, how to allocate your time to things such that it results in maximum sort of happiness and progress.
So what are the five things that you are thinking about these days, Tanuj? And then I'll come to Nandan's five things.
Okay. Currently, I obviously think number one about the book and getting this, now that we've put in so much effort into putting this together, getting this message out there. I have a day job at iSpirit and there I'm trying to, you know, create this essentially a retreat for people thinking about these large problems. So that's like the second thing that I work on. The third thing on my mind has recently been this Web3 because it's very interesting and fascinating to me, the kind of stuff that's happening, given my interest in finance and financial services. You know, these are the three sort of work-related problems I deal with. But the other two really is I've moved into a new house. I'm trying to set it up. That's the other thing. And I really need to get back to my diet and exercise regime. I have put on a few kilos in the last few months as I've been traveling to events and eating a lot more. But honestly, these are even if you look at the time budget, we give this activity called the time budget. These are my top five activities. And this is all I have time for, right? Like, and more than this, I say no to.
Nandan?
Yeah, well, I think the pandemic was a very, I think in some sense, had an impact on all of us. And I also gave me a chance to introspect on what I should be doing and how I should be spending my life. So clearly, you know, on the work front, my work is divided into what I do in the business world and what I do in the non-business world. In the business world, you know, I'm the chairman of Infosys. I run a fund called Fundamentum, and I have a few investments, though I've stopped doing investments now. Of course, in the other world of sort of social transformation, I'm involved with many initiatives, you know, as an advisor or as a conceptualizer. So many new things are happening. ONDC is happening. The health stack is happening. There's an effort to take the Indian ideas abroad globally of digital public goods. So I do both those. And I'm definitely going to spend more time on relationships and family and so on.
So these three buckets, equal time divided, or they're more in the second bucket and third bucket?
No. I would say I spend more time on the non-profit stuff than I do on the business stuff.
So on the school question, how do you take thinking into schools and teach students how to think and what to
that's
think?
That's very, very complicated, and we don't have an answer for that. We have done a lot of work on tech in education, but you know, the thing is that the pressures are immense. You know, our children are, first of all, the pandemic has cost them 2 years of their lives and the learning deficit and all that. Second is, because of the shortage of opportunities, everybody is focused on meeting the curriculum and then getting high marks and then going to some quota classes and entering IIT and all that. So we have created such a high pressure situation for our youngsters that it's very difficult for them to tell them that, you know, please step back and do thinking and learn that. But I think if we can expand opportunity for our people, then they'll feel less pressurized to do this. And hopefully that will free up their time for the thing. But it's a very complex problem to solve.
Yeah, especially with the kids more, I mean, they're far more attention starved than anybody else with all these games and all, especially these tactile games on mobile phone.
They're
far more distracted than any generation before.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Do you think that's a real problem, you know, in the next generation or two, that, you know, it's thinking actually goes out of fashion completely?
I don't know. I think finally thinking is the competitive advantage, because many of the things that we do may be taken over by robots or machines. So there's no point trying to do what they do. But if we can think, we can connect the dots, if we can have empathy, if we can negotiate between people to get results, that's going to be the hard skills. So I think people realize that if they want to be successful in life, they have to go move towards these harder skills.
These were called softer skills earlier, huh?
Yeah, the softer skills are the harder ones to acquire.
They're harder to learn, of course. But so, last question. Basically, tell us about the three modes, the create, curate, and communicate. And how do you both of you manage these three modes in your personal devices? And what is your learning from those management?
Well, it's a very interesting question. And I think when I explain my methods and Tanuj explains his methods, you'll see a lot of difference. My methods are purely using physical devices. So I do all my create, which is the hard writing articles or whatever it is that requires thinking. I do all of that on my laptop. I keep it in a particular place. And when I go to my laptop, I know that I'm going to be working. And I keep my devices far away. When I want to read and browse and stuff like that, or watch something, I do it on my iPad. That's my curate mode, where I have a whole set of things which I follow, which I keep up, going back to once in a while. I do all my communication only in my phone. I only do it through SMS and phone calls. I don't use any social media products. I do use Twitter, but mainly to disseminate my articles or ideas. So my create mode is a laptop, my curate mode is an iPad, my communicate mode is a phone, and therefore I use physical devices. When I pick up that device or go to that device, I already know in my mind, I'm switching into that mode. But Tanuj has a different philosophy, which is probably more applicable to the world.
So do you monitor the time that you spend on each of these devices in each of these modes?
Not really. I mean, my work mode is very simple. I have a zero email policy. So I do my email first thing in the morning, last thing at night. and make sure that I end the day with zero inbox so that next morning it's a new day. All my things are out of the way. I don't take phone calls from numbers I don't know. I encourage people to message me or email me so I don't have to have a conversation. I mean, these are all techniques.
So, yeah, but, you know, but similar, Yatish, how I look at it is that, you know, I try to minimize my usage of my phone altogether. It is only something that I have that I pull out if I'm on the go and I need to like book a cab, jot down a note, etc. The only thing I leave on my phone is WhatsApp, right? Like it's the primary communication method for me with a lot of people because they're on it. So I can't escape it. So that's the one sort of sin on my phone. And lately, because of the book, it's a little bit of Instagram now because I have to be there and be responding to people. But outside of that, what Nandan does, but essentially through different identities on my laptop. So, you know, most people, you can create multiple users on a Windows or a Mac laptop either, but most people don't even use this feature because...
Which is what you talk about in the book, that multiple identities, but I don't know how can multiple identities work when it's like a tab between one identity and the other, you know?
So it's not really a tab. See, what happens is that you know, friction works, right? Like it's that there's this great study that even this other great writer James Clear, who's written Atomic Habits, says that one of the best behavior change examples of moving people away from soda water to just water, right, from sugary drinks to just water, was nobody said anything, nobody gave them training, no whatever. It was just put all the sugary drinks in, you have to bend down and get it, and all the water was kept in the easier positions, right? Eventually you will grab the bottle, right? And you would not even think about it, and that's the easiest way to make that change. And what we're trying to say is that if you have a environment in your computer which is focused, which it's very hard to for you to log into social media to check your email, etc., when you make that first decision, when you open your laptop,
that would be that the laptop does not have a Wi-Fi connection, so you can't go on it. That is the only way to focus.
No,
when I have to do writing, I actually work on a desktop that is not connected to the net.
Yeah. So look, you're doing what Nandan is doing, which is have a separate device that is just configured that way, right? For some of us who can't have too many devices for whatever reasons, you can't afford them, you think it's too much cumbersome to carry, etc., you can recreate that effect with multiple identities. So in the second account, you can install a productivity blocker app, as they're called, such that anyway, it's like almost as if there's no Wi-Fi, right? And so on. But you have to do this once, set this up once, and then forever in that identity, you are constrained. And constrained not in a bad way, but in a good way. The way we put it, it is, it's not a boundary that is keeping you in. It is a boundary that is keeping the world outside, right?
Anything else that you, Nandan, you would like to tell us?
No, I think that's a great set of questions, Yatish. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. No, anything you would like to add, Tanuj?
No, I think it's a wonderful set of questions. And I really think that, you know, one message that you asked at the top, message in the book, is that these technologies are deciding both our individual lives and time, as well as the structure of societies, our relationships, our nature.
That is the part that I think needs more attention. You know, the structure of the society that is breaking up now. You know?
Yeah.
I hope you guys write about it sooner than later, because I don't think people are writing about it, but from a point of view of problem only, not from a point of view addressing what could be the solution to it, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of books written about the fact that we are living in a world that is distracted, but lately about digital terrorism and all.
I think Nandan is living the life of, you know, building these solutions, something like ONDC, UPI, etc. These are things that are actually going to be effective. But like with all things of this nature, people wake up to them and appreciate them a little after they've done, right? Like UPI, the team we were in 2015-16, we were excited, we were launching, and it wasn't getting as much traction as it does today. Because now the numbers are humongous, right? And I see a lot of initiatives like this from my point of view, which are in that same position where they'll be in their prime in a few years' time. So I am actually very excited about the future, right?
Let's have a separate conversation on that, Tanuj, because that's an interesting subject for me also. I've also been writing a little bit about it over the last few years. So
absolutely. Yes.
I'm in the process of doing a book on the next 25 years and what is the policy imperative that we should be facing. I would you be willing to write a chapter for it on this aspect, the social institution, ONDC?
Let me just send you some more information. Yatish, I'll take a look at it, definitely.
I'll send you a mail with the with the thesis of the book and also how you can read this aspect that you've raised about institution and public policy in your current book.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thank you very much.